You're listening to Radiolab. From Public Radio
WNYC
and NPR.
Okay.
I want to start the show today with a truly remarkable story, which at least initially involves this girl right here.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
Laura Buxton is her name. Remember that name.
I should tie my hair back.
And Laura, let's do this like a movie, okay?
Like a movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, it's June 2001.
Yeah.
Where are we exactly?
Oh, we're in a little town in northern England called
Stoke-on-Trent.
Stoke-on-Trent?
Yep. Imagine a little English house in this town, and the camera zooms in, and there, standing in the front lawn, is little Laura Buxton. She is 10 years old.
Yeah, well, almost 10.
Whatever. She's a tall girl.
Pretty tall for my age.
Pigtails, and in her hand, she's holding a balloon. A red balloon. You with me so far?
Yep.
Okay, so earlier that day, Laura had taken a little card and stuck it to the balloon, and on one side written...
My name.
Plus a little message.
It just said, please return to Laura Buxton. And then on the other side, it had my address.
Okay, so cut back to the outdoor scene. There she is, standing on the lawn.
It's very windy.
She's got this red balloon with her name on it, and she holds it up to the sky, to the heavens.
And I just let it go. And the wind took it. We were laughing and joking because we just thought it'd get stuck in a tree a bit further down the road somewhere.
But that's not what happened. The balloon kept going. All right, now I'm looking at a map here of England, and Stoke-on-Trent is at the top,
yeah.
So the balloon would have had to go south, like pound down, down, past Stratford,
yeah.
Past Walsall,
yeah.
Past Wolverhampton, then past Birmingham,
yeah.
Past Kidderminster, past Worcester,
yeah.
Past millions of people,
past Chettingham,
yeah. Yeah.
People with different lives, different names,
past Gloucester,
Gloucester,
Gloucester.
And all in all, the red balloon goes about 140 miles south.
Exactly against the prevailing wind.
Oh, really?
Which is a southwesterly.
Okay, so finally, when this balloon is all the way on the other side of the country, it begins to descend. Down, down, down. And of all the places it could have landed, you know, in a river, in a factory parking lot, in the sea. Instead, the balloon touches down in the yard of this girl.
I live in the countryside in a little village called Milton Lilbourne.
Just so you're not confused, this is a different girl than the first one. They do sound the same. But they live on opposite ends of the country.
The balloon got stuck in our hedge, but our next door neighbour found it, and he thought it was just a bit of rubbish, and he collected it up so the cows wouldn't eat it, because he didn't want the cows to, like, choke on the rubbish. And he was about to put it in the bin, like, literally, and then he saw the label saying, please send back to Laura Buxton, and he was like, oh my god.
Why? Why would he say, oh my god?
Okay, so check this out. Uh-huh. Remember how I told you how the first girl who sent the balloon was 10?
Yeah.
The second girl who received it?
I'm 10 years old.
She's 10. Okay?
Okay.
Wait, there's more, there's more.
Better be...
Remember how I told you the first girl's name was Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
Well, girl number two, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, hi, I'm Laura Buxton.
What? They're both Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
Both named Laura Buxton.
Yes.
Get out!
You heard me right. A 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton. Let's go of a balloon.
Phew!
That balloon floats 140 miles and lands in the yard of a 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton.
This is for real.
Yeah. I think it might be the strangest thing I've ever heard in my life.
It's pretty weird. It's
been about 8 years since the balloon incident. The Lauras see each other a lot, and we managed to get them both into a studio.
Hello, New York. This is London. Can you hear me?
So, like, we're going to hear Americans through these.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the story.
Yeah, I got the balloon.
That's Laura number two.
And I...
What did you think at that point?
I was quite young, so I didn't really know what to think. I was just like, I better write the letter because, you know, there's someone else out there called Laura Buxton. I must see them.
So Laura number two wrote a letter to Laura number one.
Dear Laura, I think I put, I'm 10 years old and I live in Wiltshire and I found your balloon. And thing is that my name is Laura Buxton as well. So lots of love from Laura Buxton.
Laura number one.
Yeah.
You get the note.
Got it through the post.
You remember reading it?
I remember reading it because I sort of opened it up whilst I was in the kitchen. And it was really quite confusing, actually, because it was like, to Laura Buxton, from Laura Buxton. I took it up to my mum and we stood there arguing about it for quite a while.
What did you argue about?
Well, she was trying to tell me that it had come to Laura Buxton and it wasn't from Laura Buxton. She just thought I was confused.
Okay, fast forward a short while later, the two Lauras meet. It was at one of England's most popular TV shows, Richard and Judy. They'd found out about the Laura coincidence, invited them on, And here the story gets even stranger, because there's lure number two standing backstage.
And down the corridor, I saw this girl who looked pretty similar to me.
First thing she notices is, wow, we're the same height.
Skinny and tall. And
got the same color hair.
Brownish hair. And
we're even wearing the exact same clothes.
Pink jumpers and jeans.
Yeah.
So you both had on pink jumpers and jeans?
Yeah.
And as they started to talk, it just kept getting weirder.
Well, we'd both got a 3-year-old black Labrador. We'd both got a grey rabbit. We'd both got guinea pigs.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And they both brought their guinea pigs with them that day.
I remember Laura took hers out of its cage and I had mine on my lap. And we were like, oh my God.
They were identical.
They were both brown with a sort of beigey orange patch on their bum. Like, completely the same.
I was just like, oh my gosh, how is this happening?
Do you believe in miracles? Either of you?
I don't know, would you call this a miracle?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it could be, but I think it's more of a case of fate.
Yeah, I'd say it's more fate than a miracle.
So you don't think that wind that blew the balloon was just wind?
Well, if it was just wind, it was a very, very lucky wind. The chances are just so unlikely, there must be some kind of reason.
What kind of reason?
Maybe we were meant to meet, I don't know.
But meant by whom? Or what?
Who knows, really? I mean, only time will tell. It could actually be, like, preparing us for something else later in life. Yeah, who
maybe
knows?
When we're old grannies, we'll find out. Now we're just young and we're just enjoying life.
Oh, Chad. I mean, what do you look? You know what you are?
What?
You're a destiny bully.
You know, because what do you call me, a destiny's bully?
Yes.
Sounds because like a pop band or something.
No, it's what you're doing to those girls.
No, I wasn't trying to force God on them, if that's what you mean.
Yes, you're the one who says, oh.
No. I was trying to get to the question of how should we think about that story?
Mm.
Is our world full of magic and meaning and coolness, or is it all just chance?
In fact, that's what we're going to do for this whole hour in Radiolab. We're going to discuss the role that chance plays in so many things.
In the lottery, in the flipping of coins, and deepest of all,
in us.
Yes.
On Radiolab.
I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
We're about to get random, so stay with us.
So let's start with a very basic question.
Let's.
Random sounds like it means random. That is, anything can happen at the next turn of the wheel.
Like your phone ringing, for example.
Oh, God.
Random.
Sorry.
Although it's happened so many times that it's no longer random. It's completely predictable.
But it does have a very nice kind of lilt to it, don't you think? I'm going to sing with it now.
It's a lucky wind. It's a lucky wind. What a lucky wind. Mm-hmm.
And now back to our regularly scheduled program. So let's say that something remarkable happens.
Like Dolores.
Like Dolores. Can you tell whether this is just the random act of an indifferent universe, or is there something truly miraculous and wonderful about it?
Excellent question.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hey, we found you.
You found me.
So this is Jad.
Hi,
Jad. And this is
very
Robert.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Deborah Nolan. I'm a professor of statistics at the University of California, Berkeley.
The reason we'd come to see Deb Nolan at Berkeley is because we'd heard that she plays this game.
I like to incorporate lots of classroom activities and demos.
One in particular that has to do with randomness.
Yep.
It's a game that helps her students understand what real randomness actually looks like. And it doesn't look like what you would think.
We call this a
in any case, she takes us into her classroom. Us and a few students.
Yes.
And she sits us down.
Yeah,
we all sit down.
Do we sit in a semicircle?
That sounds good.
And then she explains.
Okay, I'm going to divide the group up into two. I'm going to divide it right here.
She splits us up so that group one is three of her students.
I'm Joe Chang.
Richard Liang.
Margaret Taub.
And group two,
Chad Abumrad. And
Robert Krulwich.
Okay.
Is us.
And the group here.
She's pointing at us.
I'm going to give you a penny. And I'm going to ask you to flip the coin 100 times. And the three of you.
She points to her students.
Your job is to pretend to flip a coin.
Meaning they just have to flip the coin in their heads. Kind of guess.
How do you think that coin might land? Produce 100 fake coin flips.
And then Deb leaves the room. So our students start
tails.
Whipping through their imaginary
tails.
Fake flips.
Tails.
Heads.
Tails.
Tails.
Heads.
Tails.
Heads.
How many is that?
While we actually flip the coin 100 times.
Heads.
Heads.
Tails.
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 Tails. Tails. Heads. Tails.
That's exhausting.
But eventually, we did finish, and both groups then put our strings of ancient keys up right there on the blackboard.
Heads. Heads. Tails.
Woo!
And then Deb came back.
Hello. Here they are, huh? Let's take a look.
Okay, so on the board, you've got two sets of H's and T's, which look pretty much the same to us.
But she looked at their list.
The fakers.
And then she looked at our list. And right away, she says, pointing at our list,
this is the real one.
We were like, wow, what? How did she do that? Well, amazingly, the way she knew had to do with one particular moment.
Right. Roll the tape back to a moment right at the beginning of our coin flip. Seven tails in a row.
It was really spooky.
Completely.
Like at any moment, a unicorn was going to come galloping in. That's how weird it was.
But as magical and unrandom as it felt to us,
that's how she knew that we were the real flippers.
As soon as I saw the seven tails, and then I looked over to the other board, and there weren't any longer than four, I think.
That's how she knew. And when we asked one of the guys on the other team, why didn't you put more streaks in your flips? Well, he said what I think we'd all say.
I was thinking if we did that too much, maybe she would recognize that we were actually doing that on purpose.
In other words, but those streaks just feel wrong. And that's the thing about randomness. Real randomness, when you see it, just doesn't feel random enough.
But, says Deb, the truth is,
strange things do happen by chance. 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 Chance.
But why is it so hard for us to emotionally accept this? Well, it finally made sense to us when we spoke to this guy.
Hi, Jad. Hi, Robert.
That's Jay Kohler.
I'm a professor of finance and professor of law at Arizona State University.
So here's how the epiphany happened. We were explaining to Jay the unicorn experience in Deb's classroom.
Okay, we got one tail, then we got a second, then we got a third,
yeah,
and then we got a seventh.
And somewhere in the conversation, we started to do the math.
Seven,
like,
tails,
okay,
in a row.
What actually are the odds?
Let me see. Was it heads in a row, tails in a row?
Tails.
Seven
tails.
Tails in a row. That's one half raised to the seventh power.
So we started to do the calculations, and at first, it looked pretty good.
0.00, a little more than 1%.
Just over 1% chance.
Yeah.
So it seemed at first that what had happened in Deb's class was super unlikely.
Right.
But then Soren,
yeah,
our producer,
Soren,
had to go and say this.
You know, to be fair, you should tell him that you actually flipped the coin 100 times.
Oh, ho, ho, now you... wait, did you... You were holding back on me.
Wait.
Because we're too stupid to know that. That's why we have Soren here.
Are you saying that somewhere in the 100 flips you got a run of 7?
That's what we're saying.
That's not a particularly good coincidence. I'm sorry to burst the bubble.
What do you mean? And then Jay explained it to us.
Seven.
If you're just doing 7 flips, then yeah, getting 7 in a row is really unlikely. But if you're doing multiple sets of 7,
14 of those sets of 7,
which we were, because we were doing 100, then the probabilities start to add up. I mean, it starts small, like 1%, but then that 1 becomes 2, which becomes 4, which becomes 8, until when it's all said and done, the chances of getting 7 tails in a row somewhere in a set of 100 is, don't hold your breath,
about 1 in 6 chance.
1 in 6. That's it.
That you would have gotten a string of 7.
So what felt spooky and almost Twilight Zone-ish in the moment is actually...
It's not that improbable.
Oh.
See, that's why you don't want to know it. It doesn't confirm your goosebumps.
No, I think the goosebumps are dead now.
Oh, I'm sorry to do that. I still enjoy life.
The problem, says Jay, is that we were so focused on those 7 flips in a row that we had forgotten about the other 93 that weren't 7 in a row. We'd forgotten about what he calls the background. We were too zoomed in.
So you've got to back the camera up and pan around and look at the complete sample space.
And when you do that, he says, what you will realize is that the thing that felt so special...
Suddenly you see that it's not so odd and it's real context.
And this sad lesson goes way beyond coins. He gave us this example.
1985 and 1986, Evelyn Adams of New Jersey wins the lottery twice.
Back-to-back years. Crazily improbable, right?
Right.
So if you zoom in all the way in, there she is, Evelyn Adams, standing outside of a convenience store somewhere in New Jersey. She is completely blown away for good reason.
The odds that those two particular tickets would become winning lottery tickets are 1 in 17.3 trillion.
Wow. But, Jay would say, if you pan the camera back, away from Evelyn.
Goodbye, Evelyn.
And you look at the whole world of people buying lottery tickets. At this vantage point, you can begin to ask a different question.
What are the odds that somebody somewhere will win the lottery twice? And in fact, the answer to that is, it would be very surprising if it didn't happen repeatedly. And it has happened repeatedly.
Really?
For instance?
In Connecticut. Employees of a place called the Shuttle Meadow Country Club, they won twice. A man in Pennsylvania, he won twice a few years later. And California retiree won a Fantasy Five and the Super Lotto in the same day.
What?
The odds of that were calculated at 1 in 23.5 trillion.
That's trillion with a T.
One way, I think, to think about this whole thing, I think one example that sort of brings it all home, at least it did for me when I thought about the blade in the grass paradox. A golfer hits the ball down the fairway, and the ball lands on a particular blade of grass. If the blade of grass could talk, you know, the blade of grass would say, wow.
Oh my God!
What are the odds that ball, out of all the billions of blades of grass,
everywhere to the right, left, and me! It lands on me.
How did it come to be that it just landed on me?
I don't know. It's sort of like a miracle, really.
And it is sort of miraculous. But what we know is that it was going to land on some blade of grass somewhere, so it's nearly 100% chance that some blade of grass was going to say, wow, what are the odds that ball was going to land on me?
And if I were that blade of grass, I'd feel so special and chosen.
And crushed.
And crushed.
Soren. The real lesson here, according to Jay Kohler and also Deb Nolan before him, is that if you don't see past yourself, you fall prey to, you know, superstition.
Right, or magical thinking. You have to be careful that you're not finding meaning here when it's just coincidence. Just coincidence. Just coincidence. Just coincidence.
But there are some things, like Dolores, that will never feel like just coincidence.
Well, if it was just wind, it was a very, very lucky wind.
So we had to ask Jay. I asked you, sir, is this a miracle?
This is not a miracle. It's a good story. But, you know, there are lots of little things I could pick at in the story. You know,
like what?
It wasn't exactly.
Pick away.
Well, I mean, Laura Buxton didn't find the balloon. Somebody else who knew a Laura Buxton found the balloon. You selected out the features that match. And trust me, somebody checked to see if she was an identical twin and said, no, that's not a good one. Skip the twin. Okay, how many brothers and sisters? Oh, not the same number of brothers. Skip that. Ah, they both have a rabbit. Let's put that one in the story.
To be totally honest, he's right.
What? What do you mean?
Well, when I was interviewing Dolores, I asked him a bunch of questions, kind of scouting for similarities. What's your favorite color, both of you?
Blue. Pink.
Scrap that. And what do you guys study in school?
Biology, chemistry, and geography. Whereas I'm doing English and history and classical civilization.
Scrap that.
What people do is they try to make the story better by showing more similarities.
So you're saying that somebody, I couldn't imagine who, doctored the story?
By the way, I don't want to spoil anything, and this is a trivial comment, but I believe that one of the girls was actually 9.
Well, almost 10.
And the other one was 10.
Darn it! No!
Oh, well, that's the story's ruined. Never mind.
Yeah, I'm sorry to be your most depressing guest.
Nonetheless, I will continue to tell the Laura story every chance I get on the air, at parties, wherever, because, you know, damn the statistics, it just makes me feel good.
I think Jay would agree with you.
Well, we love stories. It connects us. It gives us insight into our own lives. And I think it also gives us a feeling that life is magical.
And maybe we don't have to call it magic to enjoy the experience. In fact, I was talking to the Dolores and I asked them, what if a statistician were to walk in the room right now and say to you, this was bound to happen. Statistically, this was going to happen sometime to someone.
That's fair enough, really, because it just happens to be us in those statistics. So
yeah, I mean, if that's what the statistician thinks, I mean, yeah, fair game to him.
They don't really care. The way they see it, whatever was in that wind, whether it was fate or just wind, doesn't matter. It brought them together. And now they're friends.
Radiolab will continue in a moment.
Hello, my name is Laura Buxton. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation,
the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the National Science Foundation.
Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by National Public Radio. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich, and we are talking on Radiolab about things stochastic.
Like coin flips and lottery tickets.
But let's just push this whole argument another step forward, if we may.
Which mean?
Let's talk about human beings. Would it surprise you, Chad, if I told you that on the subject of predictability, humans and coins are kind of similar?
It wouldn't surprise me because I wouldn't believe it.
You would believe it if I made you an argument so powerful and so astonishing that you would be falling back on your butt in surprise and staring at me with a kind of simple admiration that you rarely have. Because here it is. It is. I'm going to talk to you about basketball.
Basketball?
That is a sport where people...
First of all, A, what do you know about basketball?
I know.
B, basketball is a game of skill. Don't even try and pretend there's like random forces like coin flip.
Let me make you an argument. Let's just take, to make it really interesting, the most skilled basketball team ever.
For example, you could take a look at the 82-83 76ers.
The Philadelphia 76ers, Maurice Cheeks, quiet, no
pick. That's Jonah Lehrer, regular on our show.
It's one of the best NBA teams of all time.
Along to Cheeks. Cheeks to Dr. Jakes, swooping underneath, putting it up and in.
So during the playoffs, the 76ers were all incredibly hot.
Take my man Andrew Toney, an outside shooter for the 76ers. During this run, he was...
Sometimes Andrew Toney would make 5 shots in a row. He would be considered hot.
So that's the deal. Andrew hits his mark once, hits his mark twice, hits his mark 3 times. Now I'm going to pass to him because he's obviously hot.
The basket looks to him that it's the size of a soccer goal.
He's golden. He's got the gods on his side.
And why are we talking about them?
Well, because in this situation, you'd have to agree that Andrew Toney was hot, right?
Yes.
Hot, that's the word. So let me ask, what exactly do you mean when you say hot?
Why are you asking me? Because he's making a bunch of shots in a row. And if you're on his team and you're coming down the court, you pass the ball to Andrew because he's on a roll.
What the fan assumes is that after 5 shots, he'd be more likely to make his 6th shot.
That, to me, just seems like common sense. If he's making lots of buckets, of course you're going to pass it to him. How could that be wrong?
And did the players assume this? Obviously, if they're going to pass.
Oh, you know, the players all believe this?
The coaches believe this too?
The coaches believe it, so it actually dictates the plays they call. Everyone assumes it to be true, that the hot hand is a real thing. It dictates the flow of basketball games.
Thank you, Jonah. But?
The hot hand doesn't exist.
What? You just went through this whole rigmarole about the Sixers being hot.
Yeah, well, they were a great team. But a lot of scientists have looked at this question of hotness in sports. And in fact, there's a couple of scientists who actually looked at all the made shots and the missed shots of this 76ers team. And when they looked directly at the numbers, emotions aside, just the data, here's what they found.
At the very moment you think you're hottest, you're actually freezing cold.
Wait, that can't be right.
Some of these percentages are pretty damning.
Take Andrew Toney. During the regular season, Toney made 46% of his shots.
46%.
After hitting 3 shots in a row, which means he's in the zone, he's totally there, his field goal percentage drops to 34%.
So that's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm telling you, Jenna Boomrat. I've got the numbers here.
And the reason seems to be is that Andrew knows he's hot. Or he thinks he's hot, so he's taking less responsible shots. He's taking, you know, the 3-point jumper from way beyond the arc. And he assumes his streak will somehow save him.
No, that cannot be. Because, Jonah, you've been to basketball games. You see what happens.
I've been to basketball games, too.
You've been to games, and you see that someone makes 3 shots in a row. The crowd gets up. Suddenly, there's an electricity in the air. Every time the guy gets the ball, everyone stands up in anticipation. You're telling me that's all a figment of our collective imagination?
It is a figment of our collective imagination. And it's especially a figment of the way we kind of calculate streaks. The reason Andrew seems so hot is because he makes 3, misses the 4th, makes the 5th, misses the 6th, makes the 7th and 8th. And so then we rewrite that essentially random process, this mixture of makes and misses, we rewrite it in terms of, oh, it's a streak. Once we think he's hot, we tend to edit what actually happens to kind of preserve that sense of the streak.
Ugh.
Okay, don't believe Jonah. What about Jay Kohler, our statistician from Arizona State?
It shouldn't deviate. I've no
listen to him.
I have no reason to think, even if whether he missed seven in a row or made seven in a row or made three of his last four, I don't really care. I know that he's a machine. He's like a 52% shooting machine or whatever his number is.
No, but he's not a machine though. He's a person with confidence that ebbs and flows.
Yeah,
there's got to be a difference there.
I agree with you. You've just described the psychological theory that makes the hot hand belief so compelling and so hard to get rid of with data. But it just doesn't matter whether the player made three or missed three, their probability of making that fourth shot, that next one, is pretty much the same.
This is very, very depressing. Essentially what you're saying is that basketball players are like
coins.
Coins.
Yes. Yeah.
The fact is, Jed, you are, and Kobe Bryant even, is more like a coin than any of us had dared to imagine.
No.
Kobe
no.
has a pattern. In his case, it's what, 50-60-40? On any given night with Kobe, you think, oh, he's spectacular. But all he's doing is he's just having another night of his very 60-40 life. And that's just the way it plays out.
Even on a shot-by-shot basis, you're saying?
Yeah. Each shot seems to be kind of a random event.
Exactly. By the way, are you willing to concede that statistically this is a...
Not yet.
it's so counterintuitive. I still, as a basketball fan, I was just watching a game the other night saying, pass it to Kobe, assholes, because he's clearly hot. The only exception to this whole literature of streakiness is
hockey.
No, is
the sport no one cares about. Yeah.
Is it Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak where he hits for 42 games in a row? I've got it in the book somewhere.
Actually, Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak was 56 games. 56.
Yeah, so Joe DiMaggio is just about the only outlier you can find in professional sports.
He's the only real hero.
Yep.
Well, at least I got Joe.
You know what, Jed? One reason you have trouble, I think.
More than trouble.
You're not the only person who is a person of pattern and habit. We all are.
Come in.
Pattern rules the brain. Here's another story. This is, again, from Joan O'Lehrer, but this one is about a woman, mm-hmm. I believe her name is Anne.
I'm Anne Constabber. I live in a small country town where most people know other people.
Anne was a high school English teacher.
I taught for 31 years.
She now lives in West Virginia.
Wait, can you wait this minute? There's someone at my door. I'm sorry.
Of course. Anne was an upstanding citizen, went to church every Sunday, was just one of those people who...
Makes the world go round.
I'm sorry.
Not at all.
Anyway, in 1991, I would go to the grocery store, and on the occasions I wrote a check for my groceries, the woman would say, gosh, you're shaky.
And she says she began to notice that her hands would start to tremble.
Are you all right? But I just thought maybe it was because of working that hard and trying to get everything done.
And it got particularly bad when she said she was just walking in the mall doing some shopping.
And I was by myself walking, and it was like I stepped off a step that wasn't there.
It was the first full body tremor. She fell.
And then my husband was a doctor, and he sent me to a neurologist who diagnosed me with Parkinson's.
Well, how old is she, by the way?
She was at that point in her early 50s.
What is Parkinson's?
Parkinson's is the death of dopamine neurons in the back of your brain, in the part of your brain that controls bodily movement. And so when these neurons die, the end result is first the shaking hand and the loss of feeling and the loss of movement. And then, of course, the tremors get worse and worse.
But anyway.
Well, the doctor diagnosed her with Parkinson's, and he gives her a drug called Requip.
Requip was new medicine in 1992.
It's a pseudo-dopamine. It basically mimics dopamine in the synapse of the cells.
and it was like a miracle drug for me.
Her tremors disappear, her symptoms disappear.
So she's cured, or?
If you looked at her on Requip, years after she had Parkinson's, you wouldn't notice anything. She would seem symptom-free. So about 7 or 8 years go by, all the while they're upping the dosage to compensate for the cell loss that's still taking place. And in the early years of 2000, something sort of unusual happened to Anne.
Some friends of mine had gone to Las Vegas every year for the basketball tournament, the Final Four type thing. And they asked would I like to go with them. And I said, yes, I would.
So she went to watch basketball, but as often happens in Vegas, one afternoon she and her friends found themselves in a casino. Had you ever gambled before this trip to Las Vegas?
No, I was raised in a household that was fairly religious, and we considered gambling a sin.
But as she stood there in the casino in Vegas, she had this inexplicable urge to go to the slot machines.
They had frogs and princes and cars and cherries and lemon, push a button, wheels spin and see what the pictures did. I've never taken any drugs, so I don't have anything to compare it to, but it was like a high. That was sort of the beginning of it.
And then when she comes back to West Virginia,
I couldn't wait to get to a machine I really wanted to play.
She discovers the dog racing track.
It's a good spot to pull in.
About 15 miles away from her house.
I'd go at 7:30, be there when they open.
And that's where she would go, and they had a wide assortment of slot machines.
Hi, how are you?
If I had the money, I'd play all day.
From 7 to 3:30 in the morning.
Whoa.
And then she would go home and play slots.
On the computer.
On her computer. Not even for money. Just for the sheer visceral thrill.
I would play that the rest of the night. 7:30 the next morning, I'd be back at the joint.
How are you?
Without any sleep at all?
No sleep, and she could keep it up for several days in a row.
At the beginning of my gambling, I'd wake up in the night and just scream out, oh God, what am I doing? Help me, save me. But eventually I became too hard-hearted, I guess, to even pay attention to that.
Her credit cards are all maxed out.
I sold my mother's silver. I sold my silverware. Things that should have been my son's heirlooms. Stole from the safety deposit box.
She steals quarters from her grandkids.
Steals quarters from her grandkids?
Yeah.
Anything I looked at around the house, I thought I could get money out of.
Everyone who knows her is watching her life fall apart.
My house was filthy, dirty, a mess. I wouldn't take time to even wash dishes.
She lives on peanut butter.
Didn't have any crackers or bread or anything. I just had peanut butter.
Because that's all she can afford and still leave as much money as possible for the slots.
Even when I'd be at church, I'd think, well, so many more minutes or so many more hours I can go gamble.
Her husband eventually leaves her.
I mean, I loved my husband, but
they got divorced.
There's just no decision. Everything is gambling. One of the neat things about gambling is you can do it by yourself.
How much money did you lose during those years, if you don't mind me asking?
I lost at least $300,000.
$300,000.
Which to her is?
Is all her life savings.
And that's one quarter at a time.
Yeah, that's the surreal part.
Dad. Tried several things. I went to a rehab facility. I told you I was raised in a really religious home. Sometimes I would say my dad's watching me from heaven and he wouldn't approve of this. He wouldn't be so disappointed in me. But seemingly I just couldn't stop.
Let me pause here for a second, Jad. I want to just take a moment to try to figure out what exactly is happening to Anne.
Yeah, why can't she stop?
Yeah. It turns out there may be an explanation if you look into her brain. Remember earlier we talked about a little chemical called dopamine,
yeah,
and how she didn't have enough dopamine in her brain, so that was giving her some kind of movement trouble, the Parkinson's.
Right.
It also turns out to be the case that anytime you do something that makes you feel good, your brain spurts out dopamine.
For years, that's how scientists saw dopamine, as the neurotransmitter of pleasure, the neurotransmitter of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
But you said earlier that dopamine has to do with movement.
Well, what is the ultimate purpose of movement from the perspective of evolution? It's to get you to food. It's to get you to sex. It's to get you to a reward.
Huh.
So that's why the same circuits, the same chemical that controls motivation, that controls what you want, also controls movement.
But that turned out it was a little more complicated than that. In the mid-1970s,
a guy named Wolfram Schultz
decided to take a much closer look, and his subject was a monkey.
So he would put these very thin needles that can record the activity of individual dopamine neurons in the monkey brain.
And they'd put the monkey in a room, and then every day they would walk down the hall to the room where the monkey was. They'd open the door.
Hello, monkey.
They'd flip on the light. They'd give the monkey some juice.
Here you go, monkey.
And then when the monkey sipped the juice, dopamine.
Happy monkey.
Right. But then comes a surprise.
He soon discovered something very odd about these neurons.
As they juiced this monkey day.
Hello, monkey.
After day.
Hello, monkey.
After day.
Hello, monkey.
After day.
Hello, monkey.
The
hello,
squirt of dopamine, which they were always measuring in the monkey's brain, seemed to move forward in time.
What do you mean?
Well, at first, the dopamine hit when the monkey took the sip of juice.
Hello, monkey.
But after a while, the monkey got the dopamine hit when they entered the room and switched on the light.
Hello, monkey.
And then after a few more times, the dopamine hit when the researcher's feet could be heard walking down the hall. You see what's happening here?
Hello, monkey.
Not really? You're going to have to bring it home for
well,
me.
Well, I'll do it again then. What the monkey is trying to do is piece together the sequence of events that inevitably lead to juice.
Exactly. That's what these cells do. They try to predict rewards.
Oh, so this isn't just about movement or about feeling good. It's about finding the pattern of the thing that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
It's pattern finding.
Oh, this is pure pattern recognition. This is essentially how your brain makes sense of reality. In some very primitive sense, it parses reality in terms of rewards. So this is how you get more food in the wild, is you can see the reward before anyone else can.
So we're talking about like basic survival stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
There's one other wrinkle, though, about the dopamine system that makes casinos and slot machines so tantalizing, which is that these cells are also programmed to be very sensitive to surprising rewards. So this seems to be, most scientists speculate that this seems to be your brain's way of telling you, pay attention, you just got something for free. This must be good. Sit here in this nice comfy velvet chair and try to figure out this reward.
So now imagine Anne sitting there at the slot machine. She pushes the button on the machine, and oh my God.
And sirens and bells go off, coins clang.
And inside her head, her dopamine neurons, they're saying, this is wonderful! But now, how did this happen?
Where did this big reward come from?
What did you do this time?
Why are you so happy all of a sudden?
And it starts searching for something.
They had frogs and princes.
Was
and
it the number of cherries that she had just before? Was it that this machine had 13 hits and this was the 14th?
I thought I could tell.
It has all kinds of pattern-like things. It has bells. It has lights. But the problem
is that there is no pattern to find.
There is no pattern.
It's inherently random. It's inherently unpredictable.
And while the rest of us might just, you know, give up and walk away.
God, I just wasted $100 on this stupid machine. I should go get lunch.
Anne can't go to lunch. Her dopamine system is
too powerful, too potent.
Oh, because of that drug she's taking.
Right. It keeps surging and surging, forcing her neurons to fight hard, to find a pattern. That's what's gripping her. Her brain is intoxicated at the possibility that it will learn how to succeed, that it will
crack an uncrackable code.
I thought I was good at stopping the machines, in fact.
She told me a story about she would go to buy milk and then spend the next 12 hours with the milk rotting next to her as she puts quarter after quarter after quarter into this machine. Were you surprised when you learned that the medication might be responsible for your gambling addiction?
I mean, as someone had said to me, this medicine will cause compulsive gambling. I would have thought they were crazy.
It's just at that time where the first studies come out showing that this is actually a common side effect of Requip.
Really? So there were other ANDs appearing in other places? Same deal?
Absolutely.
Basically, after my neurologist took me off the Requip,
her compulsion disappeared instantaneously.
Almost immediately.
That fast?
Well, within a week, I'd say.
Wow.
It was gone.
I haven't gambled for nearly 3 years.
Did her Parkinson's return?
Yeah.
I have tremors a lot worse. I've recently gotten a cane. I have trouble walking. I use a walker.
So the price of not being a gambling addict is living with debilitating Parkinsonian symptoms.
But my son, let me finish about my son. When I told him after I quit gambling, I said, son, I sold things that belong to you that you should have. And he said, Mom, those are just things. It's just really great to have you back.
Radiolab will continue in a moment.
Hi, I'm Maddie Weiner calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Hi, I'm Robert Krulwich. Radiolab is supported by ZipRecruiter. I don't know if you know anything about ZipRecruiter. Let's suppose you need to recruit somebody for your business, for your office. You could, I guess, ask friends. You could put an ad out for everybody in the world to read. ZipRecruiter's idea is they have what they call a matching technology that presumably finds the right people for you and then goes and gets them to apply. And right now, Radiolab listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Radiolab. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/RADIOLAB. Hi, I'm Robert Krulwich. Radiolab is supported by Capital One. With the new Capital One Saver Card, you can earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on checking out that new restaurant everybody's talking about and 4% on watching your team win at home. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. So now when you go out, you cash in. What's in your wallet?
Hello, I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and our topic today is, you want to say the word?
Stochasticity.
Stochasticity.
S-T-O.
Which is a wonderful and fancy word that essentially means randomness, chance,
yep.
Like the kind that's built into flipping a coin or playing the lottery, or, to take things deeper, when you breathe. Krulwich, sing about the air that's flowing around your head right now. It's full of atoms and molecules that are flying about and smashing into each other and colliding and shooting off in different trajectories that can't be predicted. It's totally chaotic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until you breathe it all in. When you do, things get predictable.
Can I release?
Nope, nope. Okay. The point is, when you breathe in, all of those chaotic, fluxy molecules come in and become a part of the machinery that is you. They go into your blood. They go into your cells, which are themselves these little factories.
Factories full of even tinier factories like mitochondria.
What are mitochondria? I'm not really sure. But I do know that's Jonah Lehrer again, himself, a factory of enzymes.
Factories full of these intricate things. Which work and you can understand, you know, this gene makes this protein, which makes this organelle, which does this thing for the cell.
This process, says Jonah, of taking in flux and giving it a shape, giving it an order, that is what life does. In fact, you might say, it is the definition of life.
The closer you get, the more you kind of stand in awe at the exquisite engineering. there is a sense that life is simply the world's most elegant clock.
Nicely put.
Now, if life is a machine, you would think that the most clock-like, most machine-y part of life would be all the way down at the bottom.
I would think so.
Which, for our purposes, is when a gene makes a protein. Gene, protein, gene, protein. This is the basis of life. Protein. So you would think it's got to be orderly. It's got to be predictable.
Genes, protein.
Otherwise, none of us would be alive.
It is a very predictable, orderly system, so we all believe.
Pretty amazing. But then we spoke to this guy.
Am I talking? Have I been talking?
Yeah, you're all right. Yeah.
Okay.
And he mucked things up a bit.
I tend to be looking this way.
Well, what's your name?
My name is Carl Zimmer.
He's a science writer like Jonah.
I write for the New York Times and Scientific American and Discover. I blog.
And he told us that this whole genes making protein situation.
Here we are again.
As TikTokian affair as we've always assumed it to be, in fact, scientists have never actually seen it.
Well, I mean, it's very small. But finally, scientists have figured out a way to turn on a light when it happens. So they now can see a gene turning on a protein.
Literally see it with their own eyes.
Yeah.
And what they saw was astonishingly unclock-like.
You know, at the fundamental level, it's just sloppy. Sloppy. And that's the best word for it.
In fact, in our interview, he used that word 42 times.
Sloppy, sloppy, sloppiness. Sloppiness.
Sometimes use this word.
Random.
Or this.
Fluctuating.
In this
noise.
One.
Chaos. Noise.
Definitely use that one a lot.
Noise.
Jumble.
Noise. Noisy. Accident. Noisy. Noise. 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 Noisy. Sloppy. Chaotic noise. Sloppiness. Sloppy and fluctuating.
It's fluctuating.
Really crazy in there.
He started by telling us about this experiment that happened in California at Caltech. Involving a little tiny bacteria called E. coli, which is Carl's favorite.
Indeed. Yes, so these are E. coli. These are harmless residents of our gut, and they're also...
Would you call them creatures?
They're creatures, sure. They sense their world, they make decisions, they feed, they reproduce,
okay.
They have genes like us. They've got 4,000 genes. I think they're earn the title creature.
And these creatures are actually very similar to our own cells. Their genes make proteins just like ours. So what these scientists did was they took some E. coli that were exactly the same.
Clones.
In every single way.
They're genetically identical.
And then they put the whole batch in a dish and they said, okay, everyone, we're going to turn on your genes. Start making proteins. Now. And they watched. Because like you said earlier, they had found this new way of getting the E. coli to
glow.
Every time its genes made a protein.
It seems like it ought to be like just flicking a switch.
Yeah, you turn on the genes, click, protein, 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 turn it off. Turn it on, protein, 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 turn it off.
Couldn't get simpler.
This is like a basic function of biology.
Yeah, this is biology 101. And again, these are genetically identical E. coli.
Meaning they've got the same genes, they're making the same proteins, so they should glow the same.
Right. You just expect this steady glow. In all of them.
Nice and steady.
And that's not what happened. You could start with like an individual E. coli and say, okay, well, what happened with that one? It didn't start to glow. It started to flicker. There'd be a little bit of light. No light. A little bit more light. Then maybe a sudden flash. Then dark again. Then a little bit of light.
Hmm. So and they were expecting...
Yeah.
And what they got instead was...
Right.
It was completely defective. Like a car with no muffler going... More troubling still, when they looked at E. coli number two, it too was defective. Except in its own unique way. Two had his own thing going. Same with number three. He had his own thing going.
I mean, they're genetically identical.
Same with number four.
This is essentially the same creature in many different copies.
And five. Six, two.
But.
And seven.
Each one was flickering in its own.
Number eight.
Pattern.
9.
Chaos.
10.
Fluctuating.
11.
Sloppiness.
Noise.
Chaos.
Noise.
Jumble. Chaos.
Sloppiness.
Chaos. Jumble.
Random.
Sloppiness.
Noise.
Random.
Noise.
The big noise.
Accident.
Chaos. Noise. Sloppiness.
Noise.
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 Sloppiness.
Noise.
Noise.
Now this noise would not be a problem if it's just a bacteria we're talking about. But according to Carl...
it's everywhere.
Everywhere in us. We are built, he says, on a foundation of chaos.
This is very puzzling to me because if down at the deep level of our DNA,
mm-hmm.
there's just this random...
mayhem.
Mayhem.
Bedlam.
How do you go from bedlam up to... the organization that I think I represent? I wake up in the morning, I go to sleep at night. I get hungry, I eat. I breathe in, I breathe out. Listen to my heart. I am very, very orderly. I don't know how you get from this to this.
That's right. I mean, so somehow... all of this sloppiness has got to be somehow tamed because we're alive. I mean, it's not total chaos in our bodies, but...
but, you keep, this sentence never seems to quite finish. But we don't know how that happens? Is that what...
we have some ideas of how it happens. You know, as scientists start to understand how genes work with other genes, they can see ways in which you can filter out the noise and keep the good signal, keep the music.
Okay, so do you want to sit for a second?
Sure. Where do you
want to sit? Anywhere, really. Now this I find really cool. The research on this stuff is really new, but Carl says one of the ways that the body may do this...
testing. Hello, hello.
...may go from like... to... is by doing something that I actually do on the show all the time, which is use a noise filter. The body may have engineered its own noise filters. I'll just give you an example. From my world. And this is the honest to God's truth. I have a friend named Little Wing Lee.
Hey, Little Wing.
Hello, Dad.
Tell me what you're holding in your hands there.
In my hands, I have two audio tapes.
And Little Wing just recently called me up. She said, I've got these two cassette tapes. They're really old.
I think they were made in the 70s.
My mom found them in her attic, and they're of my grandmother.
One's labeled Mima Sings.
Singing. Singing old slave songs and old hymns. Now, Little Wing's grandmother died last year.
She was 99 years old.
Wow. And they were really close.
Yeah, very close. They used to call me Little Mima when I was a kid.
So she's got these tapes. She wants to hear them. The problem is, if you put it on for more than 3 minutes, you get annoyed.
And there's that weird, like...
it's too noisy.
It was kind of overpowering.
Yeah.
She wanted to know if I could do something about it.
Yeah.
So, real quick, here's what I did. I put it into a computer... launched an EQ program, found the bass noisiness, which was around 600 hertz, dialed that down, like so. Then I found the high hiss frequencies, which are around 2,000 hertz, dialed that down. Ah, now, as a final step, I just kind of located the voice around 1,000 hertz and dialed it up. Okay, so it's not a flawless process. I mean, now she sounds like she's coming out of a well, but... for the first time, you can hear her voice.
I don't know. This is the first time I'm hearing this song. But it seems like she's describing the night that my grandfather passed away. Talking about the doctors telling her that my grandfather's passed. And then she's describing putting a fern in his hand, and she said it should be a rose.
It was the end. And at last, goodbye.
The thing that's applicable here is that we started with this, and then just by bringing certain frequencies down and others up, we ended up with this.
I felt like I wanted to cry.
This might be how it is in the body, that you've got this noise all the way in the bottom, these genetic circuits which are spitting out messiness, but somehow just on top of that are other genetic circuits which are cleaning it all up, giving it a shape. Wait, what? Is that not right?
Not quite.
Damn it! Science! What's wrong with it?
Well, in our cells, there's no grandma.
What do you mean there's no grandma?
You don't start off with some very clear signal that gets masked by noise. The noise is there from the start. It's noise, and then whoop, all of a sudden you have this beautiful song.
Carl went on to explain, and it took like an hour for us to finally get this. There's nothing but noise down there at the bottom, and yet somehow the song emerges like a phantom, because it seems like the noise is somehow filtering itself into music.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to get the analogy right, Little Wing would hand Jad a tape with just fragmented sounds.
Little bits of Meemaw.
Little bits of Meemaw in all kinds of random ways.
Maybe she gave you 8 or 9 tapes.
And somehow he says it all starts to kind of get into a network where this one filters that one, and that one filters the other one, and the other one filters that 9th one.
And out of all of that comes grandma. Comes a song.
The song of a living, regular organism.
Mm-hmm.
Meemaw, literally. I mean, grandmas are made from chaos.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
You say, mm-hmm, like it's almost like, it seems like a miracle. What do you think it stands up and walks?
But see, the thing is, you've hit, I mean, we are talking about something that scientists don't understand yet.
Yeah.
So I don't have, so there's not a... If you want to have a part of this show where you say, and this, people, is how it all works.
Can't do that.
No.
But here's the thing. If you want to get fruity about this, you could say, and I put this to Carl, that if all the way down at the bottom of us there is this fuzz that cannot be predicted, then in some sense, we're free to be whatever we want.
Hmm. Well, you know.
I mean, look, I can sit here and concentrate and I can think any thought I want to, right now.
Any thought?
Sure.
But you can't think about a poem from 2nd century China.
Could you make an equivalence between loose mechanics and sense of freedom?
Well, you know, I mean, does the sloppiness and the floppiness of a protein clamping onto your DNA scale up to what you're going to be when you grow up?
On Radiolab, yes.
Okay, all right. Well, here we are then. It's called Stochasticity. Stochasticity. Flip that coin and what do you get? Heads. You get a Stochasticity.
Stochasticity. If by chance it's happenstance. Hello, this is Carl Zimmer. Radiolab is produced by Soren Wheeler and Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Lulu Miller, and Dean Capello.
With help from Jennifer Madsen, Michael Raphael, Anne Heberman, Jonathan Mitchell, Amanda Horoncek, Charles Choi, Emma Jacobs, Al Lipkin, and Ike Viskandaharaja. How do you pronounce this word?
The Stochasticity theme song was created by Josh Kurtz and Shane Winter. Special thanks to Lil Wingley and Meemaw.
Visit Radiolab online at radiolab.org, where you can comment on this show, ask random questions, and hear the entire Stochasticity theme song. Anyways, this is Lil Wing.
Thank you. Bye.